I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news now for 30 years in two languages around the world, and here in the United States, I've interviewed four U.S. presidents, worked at four of the U.S.'s major television networks, and I believe news should be honest and direct and impactful, and this is Direct Impact. So here's the story. Plainly speaking, Rudy Giuliani is in trouble again, this time for accusations that he actually went around offering people presidential bribes for $2 million. And on this show, you're going to hear from a respected and also convicted whistleblower who says he was among those. He was among those that Giuliani actually approached. But first, let's put this story in perspective. Who is Rudy Giuliani? Well, this is a guy who used to be essentially the most important law official in that area, right? He was a U.S. attorney representing that district in New York. That means he was the most important law enforcement officer in the entire region. And he was also the mayor of the city of New York. And now he's not even allowed to practice law in that region. And he's also reportedly broke, which may explain why, according to accusations made by his own assistant, he was going around looking for anybody who needed a presidential pardon from Trump, and then he would get it for them if they simply forked over $2 million. Oh, that's all? Here's part of the complaint from Ms. Dumphy, who secretly recorded her boss, Mr. Giuliani.
There was a lot of pressure to be Rudy's girlfriend as well as his staffer.
Now, the idea that somebody would sell a presidential pardon seems questionable at best, right? But then again, why are presidential pardons even a thing? In fact, the Constitution does give U.S. presidents, as if they were kings, nearly unfettered power to pardon people or spring them from a federal prison. And President Trump took full advantage of it. He pardoned or commuted the prison sentences of some 20 people, including his political allies. But he's certainly not the only president who has granted controversial pardons. Let me take you through it. 1865. After America's Civil War, President Andrew Johnson pardoned Confederate soldiers who had tried to divide the country. 13,000 of them received pardons. 1977. In a similar move, President Jimmy Carter offers a blanket pardon to all of those Americans who dodged fighting in the Vietnam War by moving to Canada. Controversial? 2017, President Barack Obama commuted the 35-year prison sentence of WikiLeaks source Chelsea Manning, who was arrested for revealing thousands of secret documents on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Let's go back to 1971. President Richard Nixon released Lieutenant William Calley from prison for killing off almost an entire Vietnamese village of innocent people in what became infamously known as the My Lai Massacre. Then there was President Ford pardoning President Nixon in 1974 after learning that he was surely going to be charged with crimes associated with the Watergate scandal. But the most, without question, the most questionable pardon prior to those issued by President Trump is surely the one that was handed out by President Bill Clinton to a business dude named Mark Rich. In the final days of his presidency, Mr. Clinton pardoned the billionaire fugitive after his ex-wife Denise Rich lavishly donated more than $1 million to Democrats, including more than $100,000 to support the president's wife, Hillary Clinton's New York Senate run, and $450,000 supposedly to the Bill Clinton Presidential Library. So there you have it. Now to the meat of the Giuliani accusations. In 2021, the New York Times reported that a former CIA agent turned whistleblower who was convicted for disclosing information was approached by Rudy Giuliani, who reportedly told the former agent that he could, quote, secure him a pardon for $2 million. And joining us now is that agent mentioned in that New York Times article, who is also a host of Whistleblowers and is no stranger to truth-telling about our government and its faux pas and picadillos. John Kiriakou is good enough to join us now to talk about this. Thanks for being here, John.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get right to this thing with Rudy Giuliani. Right. So can you just put us there? Giuliani visit you, or
sure.
how did you get this offer?
I had heard that Giuliani had been talking about pardons with various people. I needed a pardon. I had been convicted of violating the Intelligence Identities Protection Act back in 2012, and I needed a pardon in order to get my federal pension back, which is very important to
me.
So I know a guy who knows a guy who knows Giuliani. I called my friend and I said, could you connect me? So he connected me with one of Giuliani's close aides. I called the man and told him who I was and what I was looking for. And he said, well, we're going to be in Washington next week. Why don't we connect at the Trump Hotel? I said, great. I said, I work until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And he said, well, the mayor likes to have a couple of drinks during the course of the day. By 2 o'clock, he's not going to be able to conduct the meeting, so we're going to do it earlier.
They said that?
He said that. And I said, that's okay, I understand. So we met at 12 in the lobby of the Trump Hotel here in Washington.
Yeah.
And it was Giuliani and two of his aides and my attorney and me. The five of us sat at a table and for the first 10 or 15 minutes just made meaningless chit-chat. And so finally I said, so, Mr. Mayor, there's this issue of a pardon that I wanted to raise. And he stood up immediately and said he had to use the men's room. And he walked away. And I said to the aide, I said, what just happened here? And he said, you never talk to Rudy about a pardon. You talk to me about a pardon. And I talk to Rudy. And I said, okay, whatever. And he said, look, the bottom line is Rudy's going to want $2 million. And I laughed. And I said, I don't have $2 million. I'll never have $2 million. I said, and even if I had it, why would I spend $2 million to recover a $700,000 pension? That just doesn't make any sense. He said, well, the price is $2 million. And I said, well, this clearly isn't going to go anywhere. So I said, thanks for your time. Please tell the mayor I said I appreciate it. And my attorney and I got up and walked out. Well, that evening, I was invited to a book event. A friend of mine had a book that was coming out that day, and I ran into another whistleblower at the event. And he said, very innocently, how was your day? And I said, oh, listen to this, I said. And I told him.
You're not gonna believe how my day has gone. Continue.
He was outraged by this story. And so, at the end of the book event, he called the FBI. And then the FBI calls me. And said, has this happened? And I said, yeah, yes, it happened.
Yeah. And again, you did not pick up the phone and turn in.
No.
You weren't a stoolie on Giuliani. Somebody else was.
I did not rat out Rudy Giuliani. But then there was never a follow-up call. The FBI never called me back.
Uh-huh.
Well, finally, several weeks pass. Joe Biden becomes president. And then I get a call from the New York Times. Apparently, this whistleblower was so angry that the FBI never followed up, he leaked the story to the New York Times.
Wow.
And so Mike Schmidt of the New York Times called me. I happened to be in my attorney's office when he called. And my attorney said, look, you haven't done anything wrong. Just be honest with the New York Times and tell them what happened. So I told them what happened. And apparently, they had gotten the same story from another four or five people. And they published it. And then that was the end of it.
I can't help but wonder, though, what happened after this? I mean, did you sense that this was going to come back at some point, or did it just kind of die out?
Rick, I thought that it was done. In fact, I so put it out of my head that I haven't even told anybody about it since then. And then this lawsuit was filed at the beginning of the week, and the whole story...
By the woman who, by the way, is his secretary, who's also saying that he was doing very offensive things, that he was drunk half the time. Again, these are allegations.
Yep.
That he sexually acted inappropriately with her.
That's right.
It's more serious than that, but we'll just leave it at that, because that's not what this story is about.
That's right.
And then she says, as an aside, in the middle of all this, she says, by the way, he told me if I knew anybody who needed a pardon, because if they did, I could get them $2 million. Mm-hmm. She says this.
She said it.
Your words.
That's right. I was so happy that if she was going to go public with the story, that she offered up the figure of $2 million. Hmm. Because the New York Times did not say that it was $2 million.
Hmm.
At least not before Giuliani did. So Giuliani told her independently of Giuliani's aide telling me that it was $2 million. It proved that what I said was the truth.
You know, it's funny because if you look at your case, you basically are a guy who came forward and told the truth about some things that were going on in our country that shouldn't have been going on, which at the time we maybe didn't understand it, but putting it in perspective now, it's no different than the My Lai massacre.
That's right.
When one of our officials, whether they're CIA or the president, does something wrong, they should be held accountable, just
Absolutely.
Like you and I are held accountable.
Yes,
and that's
we are.
What you were trying to do. So you deserve, I think, and a lot of people believe, a pardon.
Thank you.
So in this case, though, Giuliani didn't seem interested in giving you a pardon because you deserved it. Did he?
No, in fact.
You laugh at my question?
I laugh at the question because my attorney said to me, one of the things I like about you, he said, is you've been here for 40 years and you still think that people do things because they're the right thing to do. And they're not.
Yeah.
Giuliani,
this was all about the Benjamins.
It was all about the Benjamins. And to take that a little bit further, I had dinner just two nights ago with a Giuliani family friend with whom I'm closely acquainted.
Uh-huh.
And he said that Giuliani is in such financial trouble now.
That's what I've heard.
Because of his divorces, multiple divorces,
yeah.
And because he's been stripped of his law license, as you noted,
yeah.
In both New York and Washington. He can't make a living. And so he's going from friend to friend to friend asking for money. That's what this $2 million was about. He can't continue to live the lifestyle to which he had grown accustomed.
Now, to be fair and to be journalistically sound, I have to ask you the following question. I don't know if you know the answer to this or not, but she says, Ms. Dunphy, in her statement, that he told her the plan was he would split it with the president.
Right.
With President Trump.
I read that.
So Giuliani would get $1 million and I guess the president. We don't know if that's true or not. And just because she
says it,
and just because she says what he says he told her doesn't mean it's true. So
that's right.
We don't want to put something out there.
I'll tell you the truth.
You don't know anything. You can't confirm that.
I don't know anything at all about it. And the president's name never came up in the conversation.
So he may have been freelancing.
He very well could have been.
Hmm.
And just keeping the whole $2 million for himself.
Were you shocked when you heard the $2 million figure?
I was.
Yeah.
I was because, you know, my entire life is freely available on the internet.
Yeah.
It's no secret that I don't have $2 million.
Mm-hmm.
No secret at all. So for him or for his representative to say it's going to be $2 million was just a non-starter. I have a friend who does have $2 million and does need a pardon, but he would never fork over $2 million for something like that.
But some
that.
People would.
Some people
and
would.
And there are people out there who
yeah.
would. And I'm sure there are people out there who have.
Oh, yes.
To be
Without
perfectly honest. This all started because you were a CIA agent, right? You were chief of, what was it? Chief
Counterterrorism
Ops. That's a big deal.
It was a big deal.
Yeah. These are what years?
2002 in Pakistan. So immediately after the 9/11 attacks, I took up.
So that, see, what you just said is so important. You just said immediately. This country was crazed after the 9/11 attacks.
Yes.
Between what the media was doing to us and the politicians were doing to us, you had really thought that this was the beginning of the end of the world, that this was Pearl Harbor times, 10.
We compared it to Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
At the CIA.
And it really wasn't, by the way.
No.
But we tried to do that. So everybody was going around looking for ghosts. Mm-hmm. We needed to kill everybody. And anybody who looked like a Muslim or smelled like a Muslim, we were going to take it. By the way, I didn't mean that in any offensive way.
No, I know exactly what you mean.
But the whole thing was, you know, we're out doing the sniff test for anybody who's. So that was the environment that was going on at the time. And that led to turned into practices within our own military and the CIA, where you worked. Looking back on it now, we ask ourselves, what were we thinking, right? And that's what you were pointing out.
You can say that again. Yeah, that's exactly what I was pointing out. There was one incident. It was the night that we captured Abu Zubaydah, who was the first high-value target that we caught in Pakistan. That night, we caught dozens and dozens of other al-Qaeda fighters. And we had captured so many people that we had to bring them into our safe house in shifts. We would fill a paddy wagon with 10 or 12 at a time, bring them in for interrogation. When the first group came in, they all had hoods on. And I said to one of my colleague who was working for me, why do they have hoods on? And he said, well, we don't want them to see our faces. And I said, are you seriously telling me that you have never read the Geneva Convention? You can't put hoods on them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a war crime.
Hmm.
So I ordered that the hoods be removed. And he said, if you remove the hoods, I'm reporting you to headquarters. And I said, no, I'm reporting you to headquarters for committing a war crime. So we reported each other, and I got in trouble.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Which kind of spells out what happens next in this situation.
Absolutely.
Beyond that. John, stay where you are, because I want to pick up that part of the conversation, because I think that has a lot to do with how we get to this point. By the way, I should tell you that I have a podcast where, as a journalist, as a Latino, as an entrepreneur, I tell my story. I share it with you. I also share a lot of what I've learned, and we talk about some of the stories that we're talking about right here. It's called The Rick Sanchez Podcast. I invite you to check it out. When we come back, more with John on this interesting case of Rudy Giuliani, one that he is uniquely involved in. Stay right there. We'll be right back talking about his CIA experience.
Got to do is identify the threats that we have.
It's crazy.
Confrontation, let it be an arms race.
Who is on offense? Very dramatic development.
I personally am going to resist.
I don't see how that strategy will be successful.
Very critical time.
Time to sit down and talk.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. So here's the question. What's the difference between a whistleblower and somebody spying or doing something against their own country? This is the essential question that John has had to define, consider, and pay for, fair or not. John Kariakou, good enough to join us now. He is the host of Whistleblowers right here. I asked you that question before because I wanted people to understand what the environment was in the United States at the time. Yes. And the fact that we would waterboard someone, which was torture.
Oh,
right?
Yes.
Waterboarding is torture.
Without a doubt.
Can we agree on that?
Absolutely.
You've seen it for yourself?
We were waterboarded ourselves in training.
So it's
miserable.
So it's torture.
Yes.
We were torturing people. Mm-hmm. You were essentially the guy who came out and said, we can't do this, and I have to tell people the truth about this. But as a result of that, because we were in such a heightened time in this country, mm-hmm. you became the enemy. How dare you speak the truth? Mm-hmm. We don't want truth around here. And you paid for it, right?
Yes.
That's why you went to jail.
Yes, I did.
Take me through that.
Yeah, we began waterboarding Abu Zubaydah and other prisoners on August the 2nd, 2002. And I objected to it. And I'm actually proud to say that there were others that objected to it internally. We had doctors and nurses who were assigned to the secret site where Abu Zubaydah was being held, who not just objected, but curtailed their assignments. That's a career-ending move where you request permission to come home, that this isn't why I signed up. The Hippocratic Oath says first do no harm, and they came home. I convinced myself in 2002 that somebody was going to say something publicly. And it just never happened.
By the way, to be fair, you actually defended, you didn't defend waterboarding,
no.
but you essentially made it less than it really was
yes.
because you wanted to be a team player.
Well, I wanted to offer a nuanced response, which was wrong for two reasons. One, it was wrong.
Tell us what that nuanced response
yes.
was.
The nuanced response was that.
You said waterboarding was torture.
I said it was torture.
But
I said in the case of Abu Zubaydah, it worked.
Yeah.
So yes, it was torture and we shouldn't have done it. But there are two separate issues here. Was it ethical and moral? No. Did it work? Yes.
And it was actually much more cruel than the way you presented it.
Far more cruel.
You were trying to be nice.
No. And that's the whole crux of this
story. You were trying to cover your butt.
No. The torturers let me back up. The FBI, in the person of Ali Soufan, was interrogating Abu Zubaydah at the secret site. And he was collecting actionable information that saved American lives. Mm-hmm. The CIA asked President Bush to throw the FBI out of the country. The two CIA contract psychologists, Mitchell and Jessen, took over. And they immediately began torturing him. They waterboarded him 83 times. And he immediately clammed up. But the thing is, the CIA and the FBI hated each other so much at the time that even their computer systems were not compatible.
Really?
And so everything that Ali Soufan had been reporting back to the FBI never made its way to the CIA. So Mitchell and Jessen took the FBI reporting, copied it into the CIA computer, said, look at all this information he gave us, which Ali Soufan had already gotten months earlier and reported back. Mm-hmm. They said, we waterboarded him once, and look what he gave us. It's incredible.
Yeah.
And I remember saying at the time, maybe I'm wrong about this, right? They waterboarded him one time, and he just spilled all this actionable information.
Not realistic.
It was all a lie.
Yeah.
And the CIA didn't even know it was a lie until 2005, when the Inspector General did a study. And then that wasn't made public until it was declassified in 2009.
So you disclosed essentially who these guys were. Essentially, they were torturers.
Yes.
And you put that information out there.
I did.
Why'd you do that?
Because I really believed that this was wrong.
Yeah.
You know,
do most of us today.
Yeah, and so
but in that moment, you were ahead of the curve, right?
I was ahead of the curve. And you know, it's funny, there was another whistleblower just before me, and we've never been able to identify who this whistleblower was, who told the country about the secret prison system. Mm. I've never said where these prisons are. It's been reported
in
the
media. What are those called?
Black sites.
Black sites. Yeah.
The CIA has never declassified it, and I've never said it. Journalists have said it. They've listed these countries.
And by the way, for the sake of our audience, in case you don't know this, there are laws in the United States that don't allow you to do certain things for prisoners, and prisoners have rights within the confines of any U.S. jurisdiction. So what these black sites are is an opportunity to take them somewhere else, Turkey, some would say, and other places, where things are done to them that we could never get away with.
And they were so secret that in most cases, these were handshake deals between the director of the CIA, George Tenet, and the director of the host country intelligence service, and the presidents and prime ministers of those countries didn't even know that there was a CIA secret prison on their territory.
We do this. I mean, is there some justification for something like this?
No. If we're going to be a nation of laws, if we're going to be a nation that's governed by a constitution, then whether I like an al-Qaeda prisoner's politics or not is irrelevant.
Yeah.
He has the same constitutional rights that I have.
Isn't there one exception, though? If the guy has his finger, or if you know that he... This argument is always made, and I've always wanted to make it to somebody like you. The guy we know has information that's going to blow up Manhattan tomorrow.
Right.
And by getting information from him, we could stop that from happening. I know, it's a crazy scenario, but we hear it all the time, and we see it in movies. Can you do it then?
No. That's called the ticking time bomb scenario.
Yeah.
And they train you in this kind of thing. And what they train, they're honest about the training. What they teach you
CIA.
Is... CIA. What they teach you is, number one, that only happens in the movies, right? Only in the movies.
Seems like a far-out scenario.
Yeah, except for the kidnapping of Aldo Moro, it only happens in the movies. And number two, even if it were true and you tortured him to get the information, you would have to then take that information and turn it over to an army of analysts to go through it to see what's true and what's not true, and that would take 6 months. And by then, you know, Chicago's a mushroom cloud.
Did peace activists actually gather at a Washington hotel to throw a party for you on the night before you were taken to jail? Is that true?
Yes, it was on the roof of the Hay Adams Hotel overlooking the White House.
They had a party for you?
A party.
On the night before you were sent to prison?
They gave me a gift of a set of handcuffs and an orange jumpsuit. And there was a band and an open bar, and we had a grand old time. In fact, it was covered by the Washington Post. It was on the front page of the style section.
Wow. I have to ask you, because I think people are thinking about this. CIA agent, formidable person, smart guy. You've written, what, how many books now? The Reluctant Spy, Doing Time as a Spy. These are great books that people should read because your story is remarkable. But you did go to prison.
Mm-hmm. I did.
What was that like?
Well, the second book that I wrote, Doing Time Like a Spy, is about that. Now, I was originally supposed to go to a minimum security work camp. That's what the judge ordered. But the Justice Department was so angry by what they thought was my light sentence that behind the scenes, they sent me to an actual prison. So when I went to check in, and instead of taking me to the camp across the street, they took me around to the back of the prison. And I said, no, I'm supposed to be at the camp.
Oh.
And the guard said, not according to my paperwork here.
Oh, no.
And so I told myself, take it easy. There's nothing you can do. Call your lawyers when you can. But I decided, well, I ended up calling my lawyers, and they said, look, we can file a motion, but it'll take us 2 years before we get a hearing, and you'll be home by then. So I'm sorry, buddy. He said, you're going to have to tough it out. So I decided that I was trained for this kind of thing. I had lived in far worse places than Loretto, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was going to use my CIA training to make sure I stayed safe and at the top of the social heap. And so the first thing I started to do was to form what I called strategic alliances, which were with the Aryans and with the Italians.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
And it kept me safe.
Maybe final question. You still want a pardon?
I do.
You deserve a pardon?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need a pardon. You know, as soon as I got home, without even applying for one, Governor Terry McAuliffe of Virginia offered me a pardon. And a courier came to my house with a big certificate with a gold seal on it, and he reinstated my voting rights, which was a wonderful,
nice,
generous and kind thing to do. I'm forever under the
appreciation
yeah, thank you, of Governor McAuliffe. But I need a federal pardon for my gun rights back. And I'm not a gun nut, but I miss my gun.
Yeah.
And I want it back. And my federal pension, which I need to live. If I don't get that pension back, I'm going to have to work until the day I die.
You deserve it.
So it would be. Yeah. After 20 years of federal service, I like to think that I do.
And again, you were a person who told the truth about something we all needed to know.
It's always worth it. It's always worth it.
Yeah. Well, you would do it again?
In a heartbeat. Today. I would do it again today. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, John. You're a hell of a man.
Thank you
for joining us. This is one of those stories that we like to tell. We think it's important because as we go to break and we end the show, I want to remind you of our mission here. And it's simple, really. We want to de-silo the world. We've got to stop living in these little boxes. Truths don't live in boxes. Truths are everywhere. And sometimes they matter. I'm Rick Sanchez. I'll be looking for you again right here, where we try and provide this direct impact.